With me in the Scanner studio today are Barbara Kelly Duncan, who is recently retired as the CEO of the Carolina Youth Development Center, and she has been a board member of the Children's Defense Fund, founded by South Carolinian Marion Wright Edelman, and also Professor John Hale from the College of Charleston. And John has written a new book, The Freedom Schools, Student Activists in the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. So, Ms. Kelly Duncan and Professor Hale, both of you, welcome to the journal.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelly Duncan, let's talk a little bit about you. As you reminded me, you had been on the show a while back, but it was a while back. So let's let our listeners know a little bit about who Barbara Kelly Duncan is.
My work, my career was focused on child welfare, and I've worked in child welfare in community-based organizations as well as national organizations. I was vice president for Casey Family Programs, headquartered in Seattle, and a vice president at the Children's Defense Fund with Marion Wright Edelman in Washington, D.C. And I most recently served as the chief executive officer for Carolina Youth Development Center for the past 13 years.
Where are you from originally?
Originally, I am from Georgia.
Okay. All right. John?
I am a now associate professor of educational history at the College of Charleston.
But where are you from?
I'm originally from a small town called Hartford, Wisconsin.
Hartford, Wisconsin. Now, how did somebody from Hartford, Wisconsin end up in Charleston, South Carolina? There's got to be a story there.
Sure. A long and winding story in many ways.
Well, that's okay.
Sure. I started as a high school history teacher in rural Wisconsin. And I was reading avidly on the civil rights movement and how education was used. And it was really inspiring as a young teacher. And a lot of the questions I was asking led me to graduate school, where I focused on American history and the civil rights movement. And just asking these questions, I finished my dissertation on the freedom schools, and I was looking for work, as you do once you defend your dissertation. And the College of Charleston had a call out, and was in touch with them, and they invited me for an interview, and I've never looked back.
And the fact that you, as a young teacher, got interested in the Freedom Schools, in a way, they were already history when you got interested in them.
Yes, you're right. They were already history. Mm-hmm. And then as I was conducting research, I did learn that actually Freedom Schools still existed under the program that Marion Wright Edelman founded, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. But they were already history, but they were relatively unknown. And as a young history teacher, I was very interested in reforming education, and I was reading how civil rights activists were using education beyond the Brown decision to use education as a way to enact fundamental political and social change. And I was reading, actually, at the time, everything by Howard Zinn, now the late popular social historian, and he published this article in 1964 called Freedom Schools, the Mississippi Idea. And I was reading this as a history teacher, and the idea just struck me as very innovative. And I was surprised that I had not learned about this in my education in Wisconsin. And I just saw this idea. I was very inspired by the idea of using education as a way to directly train students to challenge segregation and discrimination, and was inspired. And when I went to graduate school at the University of Illinois, I wanted to maintain this line of inquiry about the Freedom Schools, and that's what I did. And the more research, again, reading everything I could on the topic, I quickly learned that there was not a lot published on the topic, and my advisors encouraged me to stick with the idea, and that's the book that just came out.
Okay. Ms. Kelly Duncan, how did you get into the field? Where in Georgia are you from?
LaGrange.
LaGrange, okay. Been there. I know LaGrange.
Okay. Most people don't.
One of the valley towns.
Yes.
Yeah, I have to drive through there on my way back to home in Alabama.
Okay.
The interstate goes right.
Yes.
I can remember before the interstate, going through the valley towns was a very tedious process.
Yes.
So a little bit more about you personally. You grew up in LaGrange.
I grew up in LaGrange. I went to college in Philadelphia, LaSalle University in Philadelphia. And started my work, actually, in Philadelphia. My entire career was in nonprofits. Mm-hmm. So I've worked for the YWCA, Women Against Abuse, Union Industrial Home for Children in Trenton, New Jersey. So that has been my field. And it was my vision to always work on behalf of children and families. I know how blessed I've been that I was able to spend a career doing the work that I love. And John and I were talking on our way here, and I said, I've never had a job that I didn't love, about which I was not passionate. And I know that's not the case for everybody. But my goal has been to improve the lives of vulnerable children and their families.
And when did you end up meeting up with Marion Wright Edelman?
I went to work at the Children's Defense Fund in 1996.
Okay.
And a part of one of the programs for which I was responsible were the Freedom Schools, the National Freedom Schools across the country. And that's how I became involved with them.
I think we need to stop now and define Freedom Schools. And John, I'm going to let you talk about the Mississippi example. And then Barbara, I want you to explain the National Freedom School.
Okay.
Okay. John?
Sure. So the Freedom Schools, in which I write about in this book, were schools devoted to education for social change, which is actually an idea that we see.
Okay. And these are outside the regular school system?
Yes. So these are schools well outside the public school system in Mississippi. And they're actually a summer school program. And some actually were in existence for a couple of years after that. Yes. So they're part of the larger Freedom Summer campaign of 1964, in which we have 1,500 activists move to Mississippi to register voters. Mm-hmm. And Freedom Schools are an outgrowth of this massive civil rights voter registration project.
But these schools are designed primarily for really young children. This is not for college. People think of the civil rights movement, particularly as it evolved here in South Carolina, it was the college students at Friendship College at South Carolina State. But you're talking about really young children.
Yes. And this is one reason I feel that civil rights historiography has somewhat missed the story of the Freedom Schools, was that they were designed specifically for children in elementary, middle, and high school. And the idea there was to train a cohort of activists who would remain in Mississippi to carry forth the movement at the local level once all these activists return home, that they would have left behind a cohort of student activists. And that's, they were successful in doing that. So yes, they targeted students from the ages of 7 up to 17, 18 years old.
Okay. And it wasn't just necessarily activism. They were taught history, culture. I mean, for example,
sure.
African-American history was pretty much left out of the public schools in Mississippi.
They were left out of the textbooks. Now,
yes.
In the era of segregation, you do have a cohort of very well-educated African-American teachers, and they did bring in Black history into the curriculum in implicit ways, but yes, it was largely left out of the curriculum. So the Freedom Schools truly incorporated African-American history, literature, and culture into the schools.
And of course, in 1964, despite the Brown decision, almost all public schools in Mississippi are still segregated.
Yes, Mississippi was the last state to desegregate, and they actually desegregated that August after Freedom Summer, but they were the last state to nominally desegregate its schools.
Okay. And Barbara, the National Freedom Schools, what you say there, it's still part of, there's still a movement, there's still a program, National Freedom Schools. Would you describe those, please?
Yes. And of course, they built on the Freedom Schools of Mississippi because Marion was a part of that. And in the 90s at the Children's Defense Fund, she brought back the Freedom School program. So Freedom Schools are in the majority of states across the United States now, still serving children. The local Freedom Schools can decide at which age they would like to start, whether they start at kindergarten or they start at first grade. Some Freedom Schools only do elementary, some do elementary middle. So it varies according to the local communities. So when I was at the Children's Defense Fund, I was responsible for, when I say the national program, that means all of the local programs. They, for lack of a better word, reported to the Children's Defense Fund. They had to apply, they had to be accepted, and then they would receive training. The beauty to me about Freedom Schools is that it was and is intergenerational. So when you talk about the college students are still those leaders who are in the classroom. And that's by design, because they are local students who are typically from that community where the children live. so they can see that these students who look like me have gone on to college. They're doing things. So that means that that's accessible to me as well. And for a lot of those students, that's the first time they really realize that that can happen. So the college students all go to Tennessee, to the Alex Haley Farm and the University of Tennessee, to be trained in how to deliver the Freedom School curriculum. So if you walk into a Freedom School in Charleston, a Freedom School in San Francisco, a Freedom School in Detroit, they're all going to look alike. And that's because Marion's desire is that the children learn their history and they learn to be advocates. They learn that they can make a difference in the world. Parents are also involved. Parents are guardians. They're required to come to a meeting once a week during the time of the Freedom Schools. So it's intergenerational in that you have the students who are in school, the college students who teach them, and the parents who are involved. And that's a part of the beauty that makes the Freedom Schools what they are.
Initially, the Freedom Schools were designed in Mississippi for African Americans. It's still just for African Americans, or it's for...
No, it's inclusive. The focus is still on African American history because we believe that everybody needs to know African American history. So that's the focus of the historical part, but it is very much an inclusive program. One of the things that happens in the local Freedom Schools is that readers are invited every morning. These are leaders in the community. For instance, at Carolina Youth Development Center, the mayors would start the reading off during the first week of Freedom Schools. And then they would be followed by different leaders in the community. The children could ask questions of these leaders at the end of the reading so that they understood, if you're an attorney, what did you do? How did you become an attorney? And they ask amazing questions, you know. So did you ever lock up anybody, or how does that work? So that's a real part of the program as well, those morning readers who come in to read with our young people and to interact with them.
Well, when the Mississippi Freedom School started, they were not using public buildings. They were in churches, Masonic lodges, what have you. What facilities do y'all access today? Is it still, still basically in non-public buildings?
It's still the same. They are in a variety of buildings. Some of them, it depends on the city. Mm-hmm. Some of them are in schools. At CYDC, they were housed on our campus, but we had a partnership with the school district so that the curriculum-based activities took part in Liberty Hill. That's a school that's on the CYDC campus, but it's a public Charleston County school. They're still held in churches. They're held in the places where the sponsoring organization gets space, depending on their partnerships, depending on their level of funding.
Okay, so if somebody wanted to have a Freedom School in Williamsburg County in King Street, there would need to be a sponsoring organization. It might be a local church. It could be a women's study club. It could be any organization, but they have a financial responsibility when they...
Yes, they have a financial responsibility. And in some places, there are solid partnerships with schools. I'm not sure at the moment the status of the Freedom Schools in Philadelphia, but there was a point when there were 17 Freedom Schools in Philadelphia, and they were all partnering with the school district. In Bennettsville, there are several Freedom Schools, and they partner with the school district, so their schools are held in the public schools as well. So it really depends on the local communities.
How long is the summer? It's a summer. It's in summer school, so kids are giving up their vacation. How long is the session? Is it a month, 3 weeks?
Six weeks, yes.
Okay, so that's a major commitment.
Yes.
By the children and by their parents or guardians.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it is incredible. Education too, because you look at a summer achievement gap. I mean, kids aren't going to school for 3 months, so that six-week program really provides students with crucial instruction during a period of time where they typically are not receiving any education.
That's right, and that directly speaks to the summer reading loss for poor children who don't have the opportunity to go on vacations, because that's learning, vacations and all of the things that other children have the opportunity to do. So being in Freedom School helps them not to have that summer reading loss. And Freedom Schools, while call schools, because they are, it's an amazing learning opportunity. So any child who's been in Freedom School, if you ask them if they prefer to stay home during the summer or go to Freedom School, they're going to tell you they prefer to go to Freedom School.
So this is not a one-time thing. A child could stay in the program for a number of years.
Yes. Now, again, that depends on the local sponsor, because some of us believe that if children are allowed to go to Freedom School every summer, that helps to build who they become. Other sites believe that all children, or as many children as possible, should have the opportunity to participate in Freedom School. So it varies by the local offering.
Well, I think it's incredible when people complain about centralization today, that this very strong national organization permits the local sponsors can decide. As you gave us two choices, children going summer, successive summers, or children, it's a one time and getting as many. But you're allowing the freedom of the local sponsor to make that decision. It's not made in Washington, D.C.
That's correct.
There's a choice among local organizers, and we're learning this in Charleston. We're trying to start a Freedom School for the summer. You're allowed to choose the second half of the curriculum. So there's a curriculum determined in Washington, D.C., and this is a research-based literacy curriculum. But then each local center is allowed to develop a curriculum or an emphasis of study that draws on the local culture of the students.
In the afternoon.
As well, in the afternoon.
Correct.
Session,
yeah. That's correct.
Which
yes.
actually is which we observed in Mississippi in 1964,
yes.
was you have an academic curriculum in the morning, and the afternoon was devoted to political organization and activity. Now, we're not necessarily that political necessary with the Freedom Schools today, but it's up to the local school to make that determination.
Well, there is a social action project in which all Freedom School students participate. And at the training that the college interns receive when they're in Tennessee, they learn how to carry out that social action program, but with the students. So the students get to determine what they want their social action project to be. Again, depending on that local community, what do they want it to be? Sometimes it's they want to focus on voter registration. Sometimes they want to focus on cleaning up dilapidated dump that maybe their city has not done prior. But before the end of the six-week session, they always engage in a social action activity, and it's the same day around the country. So all the Freedom Schools are participating in a social action project. There'll be different projects, but they happen on the same day.
Okay. So in that way, the time, I mean, when you said it's the social action project the same day, is that there is a start and end date that is nationally set. The schools will start on like June the 15th and end on...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And what support does the national organization, if John is going to organize a Freedom School, let's just say in Colleton County, and he gets a sponsoring organization to pay for it, and they apply to the Children's Defense Fund, what is the Children's Defense Fund going to do other than say, okay, you can do it? Is there going to be any assistance? What are you going to provide that local school?
They get the training.
They get the training.
They get the training from the executive director of the sponsoring organization or whomever is in charge, the project coordinator, the project director, and the students whom they hire to carry the program out. They get training at the Alex Haley Farm in Clinton, Tennessee. And then the national staff are available throughout the summer to provide support, answers to any questions that the local schools have.
So this, John's not actually going in the classroom. He's going to hire college students that do the teaching.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Now, let's go back now to your book and the Mississippi Freedom Schools. We might want to set the historic picture for folks about, I'm sorry, for a lot of people, the 1960s are ancient history.
Yes.
The civil rights movement is really gaining national momentum. The Supreme Court decision, the Brown decision in 1954, all deliberate speed has been very slow in a lot of places. It was slow here in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. It was especially slow in Mississippi. As you mentioned, Mississippi was the last state to drop the racial barriers in its public schools. But there are also issues of voting, public accommodations. All of these are sort of bubbling up. In 1963, South Carolina had what I.A. Newby and others had described as the year of decision. They made a decision that they were going to drop the colored-only, white-only signs and public accommodations across the state. Not states doing it, the state doing it, but individual communities. And they did that under pressure from the state NAACP, which said if communities don't, then we're going to start having demonstrations here. And South Carolina was trying to say, well, we're not Mississippi and we're not Arkansas and we're not Alabama. This is a good place to invest. And so there might have been enlightened self-interest is the buzzword, but the decision was made in the cities that had been targeted, which included Columbia and Greenville, Florence, the major ones. But then you had small places like Greenwood just decided to do it on their own. Community activists, black and white, frequently clergy, sometimes in this case the local chamber of commerce went to the politicians and said, we're going to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So 63 is also the year that Harvey Gantz admitted to Clemson, and Miss Monteith, Henri Monteith, and others are admitted to the University of South Carolina. But in Mississippi, there's still very much a hard line of, you know, like George Wallace's governor of Alabama, but it's segregation now, segregation today, you know, segregation forever. And all of a sudden, you've got 1,500 volunteers moving into Mississippi in the summer of 64. And I'll let you take up the story from there.
Yeah, so in the summer of 1964, Mississippi was essentially under lockdown. The governor, especially the mayor of Jackson, they reacted as if this was an invasion, and they often used militaristic language to describe what was happening, that these outside agitators were invading the state of Mississippi, and they were preparing for this racial tension that was about to happen. It was a very tense, hostile summer. And in fact, when the Freedom Summer Campaign starts in mid-June is when we have the three activists who disappear, right, and presumed to be dead. And they were later discovered, their bodies were found in August of that summer. So Mississippi was embracing for a showdown between civil rights activists and sort of locally entrenched segregationists. They saw this as one of the last battles in the defense of the Southern, quote-unquote, Southern way of life. So they were bracing for that.
And really outside of Jackson, I mean, and you might talk about the Gulf Coast cities of Biloxi and Gulfport, but this is still an overwhelmingly rural state. The counties in the Delta are still large land holdings worked by tenant farmers.
Yes.
Or sharecroppers.
Yes.
Depending upon the farm. Mm-hmm. The school systems are rigidly segregated, and the black schools aren't much.
Most statistics point to there is at least a funding discrepancy of 3-1 in favor of white schools in Mississippi in 1964.
So where are these young activists coming from?
Yeah, so I really begin the book with the Freedom School students. In my reading of the history of the civil rights movement, oftentimes the students' voices, when you really look at the historical record and look who was participating in the movement, you have a lot of students 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, who are on the front lines of the movement, oftentimes being arrested along with adult activists as well. So the Mississippi Freedom School students were those who I've interviewed, and I've interviewed close to 25 students, and I focus on 7 in the book. They were already exposed or active in the movement to some extent by the time Freedom Summer was implemented in 1964. So they were already aware of the civil rights movement. They knew that they wanted to become active in the civil rights movement. So many of the Freedom School students were already active. One student I interviewed and spent a lot of time with by the name of Hezekiah Watkins, he became active during the Freedom Rides of 1961, and he lived in Jackson, Mississippi. And of course, anybody and everybody in Jackson at the time was either, if you had a TV or watching TV, or if you didn't have a TV or listening to the radio, they knew the Freedom Riders, as they were called, were coming to Jackson. And he wanted to go to the Jackson Greyhound bus terminal to see these Freedom Riders. I mean, they had, you know, they were legends before they even got to Jackson. And he went down to the Greyhound bus terminal just to kind of check it out and to see what they were like. And in the chaos of the moment, there was a big crowd there, and he was sort of pushed up to the front of the line, and the police arrested him along with the Freedom Riders. He was 13 years old at the time period, wasn't particularly interested in demonstrating or protesting, again, but he was swept up with the Freedom Riders, put directly on a bus, and he was shipped to the notorious Parchman Penitentiary Prison in the Delta as a 13-year-old student. And he was there for a week, and his mother didn't know where he was, and his family was terrified. He was terrified. I mean, just imagine being that age in Parchman, which is just not a pleasant place, to say the least.
How was he released?
Mr. Watkins was released more than like when the NAACP was sending bail money up to Parchman to release the prisoners. Because he was so young, he was selected. He was not part of the jail no bail campaign.
All right, so this young man has been motivated.
He was motivated, yeah. He was not intimidated. And there are other students, Eddie James Carthen, who is on the cover of the book, and he's one of the central figures that I interviewed and incorporated into the narrative. He was in the Delta. He was in Chula, Mississippi. But he was from a family, a very rare African-American family in the Delta, in which they actually owned their own land. And this, we traced it back together to Roosevelt's New Deal, where some African-Americans in the South did benefit from land grants or assistance to own land from the federal government. And what this did was this, owning this land in the Delta, him and his family were able to organize a cooperative of sorts among other landowners and to own your own land. And they actually participated in forming cooperatives. And the way Mr. Carthen describes it is he was introduced at a very young age to the ideas of cooperative ownership, democratic decision making. They'd have weekly community meetings. Out of these meetings grow discussions about registering to vote, for instance. So he, again, was already familiar with or at least exposed to principles of the civil rights movement. And I say this because a lot of these young people, they didn't have to learn from outside activists coming in. They were already practicing principles of the civil rights movement. So attending the freedom schools was actually a natural extension of the work they were already conducting in the state of Mississippi.
All right. We have to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking to Barbara Kelly Duncan, former CEO of the Carolina Youth Development Center in Charleston, and Professor John Hale from the College of Charleston. And we're talking about freedom schools initially in Mississippi in the summer of 1964, but also what Ms. Kelly Duncan has done with her career, freedom schools in the country in 2016. John, back to this book. Freedom schools, that's been an interest of yours for quite some time. How did you go about selecting those students?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's not a lot of archival material on the students themselves. Their names come up in attendance sheets that freedom school teachers were required to keep, or there's also a collection of freedom school newspapers that are in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee paper. So you see students' names and some of their work, but I really wanted to meet the students. So, you know, I'm coming from the Midwest. I'm very interested in Mississippi. I don't know anybody in Mississippi, and I started this research in 2004. So what I did is I emailed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee listserv, which is still, they still actively email and you know, communicate with one another. And I emailed the listserv and I said, you know, I'm a history teacher beginning graduate school. I'm interested in researching the Freedom School. Does anybody know any students? And SNCC was very helpful in pointing me in the direction of students who not only, you know, were Freedom School students, but were interested in talking about that story. So And that just started the process. And the first student I actually met was Eddie James Carthen. And I've known him the longest of all the students I've interviewed. But once you start meeting one activist, you know, he remembers someone, and then it's just sort of a snowballing effect in that way. So SNCC was really crucial in helping me locating students. And then once I met the students, that was a network that just developed onto itself.
So you spent a lot of time in Mississippi.
I spent a lot of time in Mississippi. I'm quite familiar with the Freedom School locations, which, you know, there were 41 across the state of Mississippi in 1964. So I'm very familiar with where the Freedom Schools were located and have really developed a deep appreciation for the Magnolia State.
Well, you've got the locations of the Freedom Schools.
Sure, in the book, yeah.
In a map. And I do know Mississippi. It's interesting. I'd expect a number in Jackson, Hattiesburg. I'm a little bit surprised by the number in Hattiesburg. But again, yep. in the southeastern part of the state, that's a big hub city.
Yes, it is.
And then you've got some on the Gulf Coast. But there are not as many in the Delta as I thought there might be.
No, there's some in Clarksdale, as I referenced, you know, there was one in outside of Chula and Milestone, Delta. There's not. So when you think about the Freedom Schools were an outgrowth of the Freedom Summer Project, that was a massive voter registration campaign. So they divided the state into four congressional districts. So what you see where the Freedom Schools are primarily located are the sort of the locations of each congressional district. And Freedom Schools naturally gravitated toward those sort of hubs or the Freedom Houses that were used to provide shelter for the voter registration workers. So Hattiesburg was a natural location, Jackson as well. But what's interesting about the Freedom Summer campaign and really the work of SNCC was very unique in their approach to civil rights organization in that they specifically targeted the poorest of the poor, those working on the Delta farms, plantations, if you will, right? Those who, you know, were unemployed, they were targeting those who that the NAACP was not really working with. And that brought the Freedom Schools into, there weren't that many of them, but that brought the Freedom Schools into rural locations that had never had an NAACP chapter or had, you know, were really for the first time being exposed to the civil rights movement. So it really brought the Freedom Schools and the organizers behind the Freedom Schools really brought the civil rights movement into the depths of the Mississippi interior.
All right. So we've got these activists, 1,500, moving into Mississippi in the summer of 64. Is SNCC the coordinating agency for this?
SNCC is one of the primary organizations behind it, but they actually develop a coordinated council to coordinate the entire effort, and that is the Council of Federated Organizations, known as COFO. So there, that was an umbrella organization. So NAACP was involved. They were raising a lot of the money to bail out.
Your core. Congress for Racial Equality.
And Dave Dennis was leading the core branch of it. Dave Dennis is also now living in South Carolina. SNCC was providing a lot of the field directors of the program. And SCLC, Dr. King's organization, was also involved as well.
Well, you know, it struck me when I read your book and why you were doing it is in the stories of the civil rights movement in Mississippi, the students are left out. The activists are discussed, many of whom are from out of state, mm-hmm. and they're white. And then in the discussion of the civil rights movement in Mississippi itself, African American women get left out of the story. It's a man's story. I mean, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, people forget that the role that Fannie Farmer played in the civil rights movement in Mississippi. Yep. Or you read Coming of Age in Mississippi.
And Moody, yeah.
And the story has been, you know, you have brought to everybody's attention the folks for whom the summer was designed. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I hope so, at least, that it to the front.
I mean, you know, John, it's great to talk about the university or the college, but what about your product, your students?
Sure.
That's, you know, those that are ending up making a difference.
And, yeah. That was writing the book. I really wanted to correct what I saw were sort of gaps in the literature. One was that a lot of times Freedom Summer is told as a sort of whitewash history because there were so many white activists moving to Mississippi that generates the attention and the press was paying attention. That was the news story. White people were moving to Mississippi. They must be crazy. They're insane to actually want to do that. And they captured America's attention. And they've really, you know, they haven't let go since then. So they generate a lot of the tension. But again, I start with the students because they have such an inspiring story. They were already active. And in many ways, the students were teaching the teachers more than they were teaching the students, just introducing them to the way of life in Mississippi. How do you survive in Jim Crow Mississippi? I mean, it does take survival skills to just live in the heart of segregation in the state of Mississippi. So it was a really inspiring story to follow the students and to try to listen to their story and to communicate that or convey that to the best of my ability to really show that, you know, these students were active. This summer was about them. And also to correct the narrative of Mississippi Freedom Summer, you often conclude that story as one of failure with the Atlantic City and the failure to seat the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and then the outgrowth of the Black Power movement. Mississippi Freedom Summer registered voters, but it's largely framed as a narrative of failure. If you follow the students, you can actually see how successful the Freedom School program was. Every student I interviewed and teacher remained committed to the civil rights movement in one way or another throughout their entire career. And when you focus on the students, you get that story. You can see how successful that educational program actually was.
And the fact that, as Barbara mentioned earlier, with the contemporary freedom schools, you're dealing with students in a community and teachers who look like that community, but these students from the 64 are still in Mississippi.
Yes. The students still in Mississippi, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
they remain in the
state. So
yeah.
That they are, each one of them represents a six. Yes, this was a mission of the Freedom Schools, is these students will then become part of their community and they will make a difference.
Yeah, and it's interesting, another outgrowth of the Freedom Schools is you actually have they call themselves the Mississippi Student Union. So here are students organized across the state. They form their own union. And with this union, beginning in the fall of 1964, they launch a series of rather successful boycotts of their public schools. It's just one activity that they participated in after Freedom Summer.
Okay. Well, back here in South Carolina, we didn't have Freedom Schools, but we had something called Citizenship Schools. And what's the difference?
The Citizenship Schools are wildly successful educational program in the Civil Rights Movement. And as you mentioned before, you know, it's led largely by African-American women. And for that reason, I feel that historians have oftentimes missed talking about the significance of the schools. We do recognize it, but it's not a story that's commonly known. And the Citizenship Schools start, it's an idea that's born in the Sea Islands of South Carolina. Esau Jenkins actually comes up with the idea, and Esau Jenkins lives on John's Island, and he's actually trying to organize a high school on John's Island, and there is no such high school. Charleston County does not provide one for John's Island. And at the same time, he understands that in order to build a school for John's Island, he is going to have to probably have representation on the school board. So he tries running for school board unsuccessfully. One, obviously, it's very difficult to run for office as an African American in the 50s. So he's trying, he realizes obviously the major problem is a lack of black registered voters. So the question is, how do you register black voters given all these literacy clauses that are in the Constitution to prevent African Americans from voting? So he begins to educate local African Americans on John's Island about how to read and interpret the state constitution in order to pass these literacy tests. And he's a very innovative individual. He's a business owner, and he owns several businesses in Charleston, a radio station at one point. And he has this Volkswagen bus, which you associate with the Summer of Love in the late 60s, but he has this Volkswagen bus, and he's driving this from John's Island to downtown Charleston because one of his businesses is providing transportation to people who work downtown. So he's driving this VW bus, and on the back of it, it says, "Hate is expensive, love is progressive." So he's sort of this radical, and people sort of dismiss him as this fringe radical from John's Island when they see this bus, you know, traveling through Charleston. But in that long ride, an hour or so ride at times from John's Island to Charleston, he's explaining the Constitution, and he turns this into a mobile schoolhouse. He's training adults how to pass these tests because, you know, he wants to register local African Americans in order to be elected to office. Well, he's working with this idea, and he becomes friends with Miss Septima Poinsett Clark, who was a teacher at John's Island, and they eventually meet. They knew each other because Esau Jenkins was a former student, but they meet later in life, and she invites him to Highlander Folk School in eastern Tennessee. And Highlander Folk School, as we know, is a very influential school for training activists and labor union organizers, what have you. And at this workshop that Miles Horton is hosting at Highlander Folk School, he proposes this conundrum, this problem that he's facing, is how do you register voters in the Sea Islands of South Carolina, and how do you organize them and register them successfully? Out of this conversation, they develop this idea of forming what they call a citizenship school. Let's start a school on John's Island that specifically trains adults in literacy, of course, but also studying the actual questions that the registrar is going to give you when you register to vote.
And I need to give a historic footnote because, yes, there were different questions for voters of different races. Standard procedure, and I faced this in Alabama when I went to register to vote, and my grandmother had to take me because in Alabama you had to have a registered voter accompany you to attest that who you were. So what does that do to working people? You know.
Sure.
So I go there, and there are already federal marshals taking care of registration in Alabama. And there were two stacks of paper, and it used to be, well, if a white person was there, you got one thing, which was a very simple thing about maybe two or three lines about almost what is the state of Alabama. The other was something about tax law. Well, the marshal, they had shuffled everything. I got one about the tax law. Didn't stop me from voting, but I understand from a friend who used to be a poll watcher here in South Carolina that was exactly, evidently the southern states figured if they could throw up a paragraph from the tax code, you know, that not even a really good lawyer could understand, then that would keep people they did not want to register to vote from voting.
Yes.
And sadly, in South Carolina, it wasn't always just African Americans. Sometimes in some towns, they didn't want mill workers to vote. So,
sure.
I mean, it's a way of keeping those out that the power structure doesn't want to have a voice.
Exactly. And had the constitutional justification to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, that literacy test has, you know, that's now been abolished. But yeah. Esau Jenkins, he had to persevere because he's starting this before the Voting Rights Act.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that means they're not federal marshals supervising. So when folks want to go to the registrar's office, whether it's in Charleston or Colleton, they might be going in Colleton County, does he instruct his students how, if when they get to the window, the shade comes down and says, we'll be back in 12th of never or
sure.
whatever?
Yeah, so he instructs them. I mean, what you see in John's Island is you see students going individually one at a time. But once the registrar begins to notice that there's more and more local African-Americans attempting to vote, right, they become suspicious, right? And that's when you begin to see these sort of freedom marches and larger groups of black citizens going down to the courthouse together to, you know, gain strength in numbers as well. But then also turn that march to the courthouse as an act of protest. And that's what you see a lot across the South. So, you know, there's certain strategies that you have to employ in order to successfully mm-hmm. register to vote. But sometimes it's just, even if you're unsuccessful, because I've interviewed people where even if you answered all the questions correctly, they're still not going to allow you to register to vote. And sometimes, at least in Mississippi, I've heard the story more than once where this white registrar, if you pass the test, he's visibly surprised. And then oftentimes they had a jar of, I've heard, you know, it was marbles or stones or sometimes watermelon seeds, and they put that jar on the table and then say, you know, how many watermelon seeds are in this jar? Basically, it's impossible to vote no matter what.
Okay.
In Mississippi.
Barbara, the Freedom Schools have been around since 1964, and you talked about they're all over the country. Are they still focusing as much on voting or activism, or is it more community building?
Yes, they're focused on both. I mentioned the National Day of Social Action, where you can choose in your community the focus that you'd like to take. But the overall goal of that is to help the students and the college interns understand the importance of being advocates for children and helping to make the community better, even after they leave Freedom Schools. Just as it was in Mississippi, the college students are chosen so that they do become leaders. And we expect that they will be leaders throughout their lives. They may not be leaders in education specifically, but no matter what you're doing, no matter what your profession, you can always give back. So we do ask that out of the Freedom Schools movement comes more activists and advocates on behalf of children. And they do that. It's just a natural. Once you've been involved in Freedom Schools at any level, it changes your life forever.
And so really the main goal now is advocacy for children. It might be education, it might be neighborhood improvement, but it's to make the lives of children better, not just now, but future generations.
Yes, to make a difference.
I like that phrase, to make a difference.
Right. They're taught that I can make a difference in myself, I can make a difference in my community, I can make a difference in the world. Because young people don't understand that. They think that they're not important enough and that you have to be important to make a difference, and you don't. And we know how often one person can make a change. So if we can put hundreds of thousands of young people out there knowing that they can make a change, our communities will be better, as well as our world.
Well, and I know this is what the students in Mississippi faced in 1964. Change didn't happen right away. And I would assume in your curriculum is students know that, yes, they can make a difference, but sometimes, I mean, today everybody wants something to happen. You click your fingers and it happens right now. But that's not the way the world works.
No.
So you help prepare them for that, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like the ant and the rubber tree. You know, you've got a little bit at a time. And, I mean, is that?
Yes. Patience, discipline are important attributes for our young people. And a lot of the teachers in public schools will say, when the students come back in August for us, but for most of the country, September, they can tell that they've been a part of Freedom Schools because they're different. They think differently. They approach school differently. We don't have grades in Freedom School. If you can't read, you're not ridiculed. You just learn how to read, how to understand. You're made to feel important. The National Freedom School theme song is "Something Inside So Strong." And that's what those young people really come to know, that there is something in them that's so strong that nothing can keep them down if they persevere.
Okay. On an average year nationally, do you have any idea how many children go through the program?
It's over 100,000. I don't have the number with me.
But that's a general idea.
Yes.
In South Carolina, how many Freedom Schools are operating now?
Well, there are currently two in Charleston, the one at CYDC and the one at Metanoia. I'm not sure how many are in Bennettsville, at least three or four. And there was one in the upstate. I'm not sure if it's still operating or not. So we'd say close to 10 operating in South Carolina.
Well, the fact that there are three or four in Bennettsville, which is a small town and a small county, but again, an overwhelmingly rural county.
Yes.
Where I was going to say the traditional model of providing something for students in the summertime, particularly the reading continuum that you talked about, would be very important.
Certainly. And I would be remiss not to state here that we are trying to start one in Charleston as well. One outgrowth of this research is obviously being inspired by the model. But when you look at just really learning, especially the contemporary implications of the Freedom School model, it's just such a positive and beneficial educational program that people forget about Charleston, you know, a wealthy tourist attraction for the state. But there is a community in Charleston that is not being served by the public schools, and a Freedom School can really help address that. So there is a small group of us in Charleston attempting to create the first Freedom School in Charleston as well.
Not the first Freedom School in Charleston.
Downtown Charleston.
Downtown Charleston.
I'm sorry. The first Freedom School in downtown Charleston.
Yes.
There are two in North Charleston.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, you said you've retired. What's next for you? I know you're not going to give up working for children.
Again, John and I were talking on our way here about all of the things in which I've become involved, all the volunteer activities which now consume my time. So I'm one of your regular retirees, taking on as much or more in my retirement as I did when I was working.
But your focus still is on children and families.
Absolutely, yes.
You want to name any of the organizations you're working with?
I am working with Cradle to Career on their board. I'm on the board of the Sophia Institute, and I am co-leading the Council on the Social Justice and Racial Equity Council, which is also an initiative of the Sophia Institute. It was born out of the Emmanuel 9 tragedy, and we have amazing community leaders on that council who definitely want to make a difference in Charleston now and in the future.
Okay, and John, what about you? What's your next project?
So the current project that I'm working on now is a history of Southern Black high schools and their role during the Civil Rights Movement. So something I learned during the research for the Freedom Schools was not only how active young people actually were, but just that their stories often dismissed in the larger civil rights historiography, and also how high schools themselves were politicized spaces. And we've again developed a narrative failure about Black public schools when in fact they did the most they could with a lack of sources or resources, and that really looking at the high schools is one of the several incubators of the civil rights movement. And as I mentioned, of course, trying to start a freedom school in Charleston, and Charleston, there's a changed landscape after the AME tragedy. So working with Barbara and others to just try to raise awareness about particular issues that still continue to plague Charleston in some ways, but also to really point out the potential that not only the city of Charleston, but the state of South Carolina holds in addressing some of these fundamental issues.
Well, Barbara Kelly Duncan, former CEO of the Carolina Youth Development Center, and John Hale, professor at the College of Charleston, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I found it interesting, particularly talking with John Hale, about why a young man from Wisconsin ended up writing a book about the Freedom Schools in Mississippi in 1964. And it all started with his high school students asking him questions, and he didn't have the answers. Took him to graduate school, and it brought him to Charleston. And then Barbara Kelly Duncan, who from her home in LaGrange, Georgia, has been involved with working for families and children throughout her career, and most notably with the Children's Defense Fund, which of course was founded by South Carolinian Marion Wright Edelman. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.